John Bachman, who pierces people's face. The K is for the kill, L is for the lover, and the M is for the mutiny, and I wish it didn't happen.
Pirate radio, pirate radio, pirate radio, arg, arg, arg. Pirate radio, pirate radio, pirate radio, where's my drum?
Now the N is for knots, oh no, my bones are sinking. The B is for the peg leg that keeps me standing up. A Q is for quantum leap, R is for the rum, and the S is for the scurvy, which I wish I didn't get.
Pirate radio, pirate radio, pirate radio, arg, arg, arg.
That's underneath my boat. And B is for Mukitas, who plays a sour note. W is Tiasis, X marks a spot. Why? Cause I'm a pirate.
Pirate radio, pirate radio, pirate radio, arg, arg, arg. Pirate radio, pirate radio, pirate radio, where's my grog?
This is WSQT Direct Action Radio, broadcasting on 88.1 FM from the heart of occupied Washington. We are news from the front line. We can be reached at WSQTRadio@hushmail.com, WSQTRadio@hushmail.com.
Welcome to Palestine Today, a service of the International Middle East Media Center, www.imemc.org, for Monday, May the 2nd, 2011. The Palestinian Prisoners Society, PPS, reported on Friday evening that four Palestinian political prisoners were injured after the draw unit of the Israeli military broke into Section 10 of the Eshel prison compound, where 114 detainees are presently being held. Prime Minister of the Hamas-led de facto government in the Gaza Strip, Ismail Haniyeh, demanded that the Palestinian Liberation Organization, the PLO, withdraw its recognition of Israel after Tel Aviv announced its rejection of Palestinian unity deal. Two children and a youth were injured, and three Israeli activists were arrested on Friday as Israeli troops attacked the weekly anti-war protests taking place in Bilin, Nilin, Al-Nabi Saleh in the central West Bank, as well as Al-Masara village in the south. In an interview with Al Jazeera Television on Friday, Egypt's foreign minister announced that the interim Egyptian government has decided to reopen the border between Egypt and Gaza, and will begin in the next few days to begin easing the blockade on Gaza. Israeli forces attacked a non-violent protest near Qalqilya on Sunday, injuring several international activists, including a 60-year-old woman who was hit in the head by shrapnel. Three international peace activists were arrested by Israeli forces and faced deportation and probable 10-year bans from the country. On Monday, accompanied by senior Hamas delegates in exile, head of the political bureau of the Hamas movement in Syria, Khaled Mashal, arrived on Sunday evening in Cairo in preparation to sign the Palestinian Unity Agreement with Palestinian President Mahmoud Abbas. This sums up our news for today. Thank you for joining us from Occupied Bethlehem. You have been listening to Palestine Today from the International Middle East Media Center. For more updates, please visit our website at www.imemc.org. This report has been brought to you by Hussam Fossis and me, David Steele.
welcome to This Week in Palestine, a service of the International Middle East Media Center, www.imnc.org, for April 23rd to 29, 2011. Palestinians reach a reconciliation agreement that's not welcomed by Israel and the United States. Meanwhile, Israeli settlers and military step up attacks against Palestinian communities. These stories and more are coming up. Stay tuned. Let's begin our weekly report, as usual, with the non-violent activities in the West Bank. With IMEMC's Frederica Kallström.
Two children and a youth were injured. Three Israeli activists were arrested on Friday as Israeli troops attacked the weekly anti-wall protests taking place in Bilin, Nilin and Al-Nabi Saleh, central West Bank, as well as Al-Masara village in the south. This week, protesters welcomed the national unity deal signed by Palestinian factions in Cairo on Wednesday. In Berlin, an 8-year-old boy was injured. Many were treated for the effects of tear gas inhalation during the weekly protest there. Like every Friday for the past 6 years, international and Israeli supporters joined the villagers after the midday prayers and marched up to the wall to protest. Upon arriving at the gate of the wall, troops stationed there fired tear gas and rubber-coated steel bullets at protesters, leading to their injuries. In Al-Nabi Saleh, a 13-year-old child and a young woman were injured. Three Israeli supporters arrested when troops attacked the weekly protest against the wall and settlements. International and Israeli supporters marched up after the midday prayers to the land where Israeli plans to build a new settlement. Troops attacked the villagers as soon as they reached the lands and forced them back into the village. Later, troops stormed the village and fired chemical water and tear gas into people's homes. Many were treated for the effects of tear gas inhalation. In the nearby village of Nalin, villagers along with their Israeli and international supporters marched up to the wall where soldiers fired tear gas and sound bombs at them. Many were treated for the effects of tear gas. This week, protests ended with clashes between soldiers and local youth. Al-Masara village in the southern West Bank, international and Israeli supporters joined the weekly protest against the wall and settlements, and Israeli troops stopped villagers from reaching the construction site of the wall and used rifle butts and batons to push people back into the village. Israeli troops also arrested two French activists before the weekly protest had ended. For IMEMC.org, this is Fredrika Kjellström.
This week, rival Palestinian parties Fatah and Hamas signed in Cairo an agreement on national unity. The signing bred various reactions from the region and the world. IMEMC's Rami Al-Mighari has more.
Rival Palestinian parties Fatah and Hamas came to a historic agreement on Wednesday in Cairo. After a 4-year split, the factions say they will form a unity government and move towards elections. Officials from both parties confirmed that Palestinian President Mahmoud Abbas of the Fatah Party and Hamas's top political leader Khaled Mashal will sign a unity deal in Cairo next week. The agreement was officially announced at a press conference in the Egyptian capital. Under the agreement, a new cabinet will be formed, which will begin preparing the Palestinian territories for elections. Senior Hamas leader Mahmoud al-Zahar spoke to Al Jazeera about the agreement.
Election for Legislative Council, the presidential post and the Palestinian National Council will be held all together at one. It will happen 1 year after signing the National Conciliation Agreement with the participation of all Palestinian factions.
In relation to the agreement, Israeli officials expressed concern and said that Palestinian President Mahmoud Abbas will have to either choose between peace with Israel or peace with Hamas. Israel considers Hamas a terrorist organization that is dedicated to the destruction of Israel. Right after the conciliation news, Israel called on key international players like Washington and the EU not to recognize a Palestinian state declaration the Palestinian Authority is set to ask the UN to embrace by next September. Washington called on any upcoming Palestinian government to renounce violence and abide by previously signed peace agreements between Israel and the Palestine Liberation Organization, chaired by President Mahmoud Abbas. Also, it threatened to withhold financial assistance to the Palestinian Authority. Two Palestinian negotiators, Saeb Erekat, rejected Israeli concerns outright as interference in Palestinian affairs. Erekat regarded the unity agreement as a purely Palestinian issue that has nothing to do with peace with Israel. Hamas and Fatah split after Hamas won elections in January 2006. In June 2007, Hamas took over Gaza and ousted the Abbas-led Fatah Party from the territory. Since then, Israel has imposed a crippling blockade on the Gaza Strip. In a related news, Egyptian Foreign Minister Nabil Al Arabi hinted at the possibility that Egypt would largely ease travel restrictions on the Egypt-Gaza borderline for both Gaza residents and goods. Palestinian sources welcomed the statement, while Israeli sources voiced out fear this would enhance Hamas's standing in the Gaza Strip. Prior to the fall of former regime of Egyptian President Hosni Mubarak in February, Egypt has imposed severe restrictions on movement of Gazans on the Rafah crossing terminal in southern Gaza, allowing only occasional opening of the crossing for special cases such as patients, students, and people with residency permits in nearby Arab countries. Closing the Rafah crossing terminal coincided with the Israeli enforcement of the siege on Gaza in June 2007. Rami Al-Midani, IMEMC.org, Gaza.
Israeli settlers intensify assaults against Palestinian communities and Israeli gunboats open fire at Palestinian fishermen in the Gaza Strip. The details are coming up. A group of armed extremist Israeli settlers hurled Molotov cocktails at several Palestinian stores in the southern West Bank city of Hebron late Wednesday, setting four stores on fire in Al-Kazazin market in the Old City. Palestinian firefighters rushed to the scene but were blocked by Israeli soldiers, declaring the area a closed military zone. Also in Hebron area, Israeli settlers dumped sewage water from the settlement of Kfar Atzion, causing serious damage to farmlands in the village of Beit Umar. Ibrahim Sabarna, whose land was flooded, said this flooding happens frequently. On Monday, a group of extremist settlers attacked a number of Palestinian homes near the Kiryat Arba illegal settlement inside the city of Hebron. Settlers also attacked a car that belongs to resident Mohammed Al-Kamiri from Hebron and broke its windshield. However, no injuries were reported. Staying in the West Bank, a large force of Israeli military invaded the northern West Bank city of Tul Karim Wednesday morning. A Palestinian source said a number of military vehicles entered the city and opened fire in the air in the early hours of the morning, causing panic among the residents. It is believed that this incursion came after a Palestinian security officer shot a single bullet as an Israeli military vehicle was passing near Tul Karim Tuesday night. However, a Palestinian security chief said the bullet was fired by mistake and no injuries were reported. Palestinian sources reported that hundreds of Israeli settlers, mostly armed, roamed around the city of Nablus in the northern part of the West Bank. The motion by the settlers came 2 days after an Israeli settler was shot dead in Nablus, believed to be by Israeli military gunfire by mistake. The settler was killed when he was with a group of other settlers who invaded Nablus and attempted to enter the tomb of Joseph in the city. According to Palestinian sources, PA police tried to stop them, however the settlers pointed their guns at the police. The source added the police opened fire in the air to stop the settlers. Immediately, a nearby Israeli military post responded to the source of fire, which led to the settlers' death. A group of at least 10 armed Israeli settlers violently attacked several farmers in Wadi Kana near the West Bank city of Salfit and hurled stones at them, wounding a number of farmers, including an 84-year-old woman. In the meantime, Israeli soldiers imposed a tight closure on the village of Azzoun near Qalqilia in the West Bank Tuesday morning. Head of the village council, Ahmed Imran, said Israeli troops set up temporary checkpoints at all the entrances of the village and denied entry and exit to anyone. Imran said he is not informed of the reason behind this closure. In Jerusalem, settlers attacked on Sunday a group of Palestinian children with batons and used pepper spray against them. The children were treated for the effects of the pepper spray in their face, especially in the eyes. A number of Israeli armored vehicles carried out a limited invasion into an area east of Khan Yunis in the southern part of the Gaza Strip on Wednesday morning. Soldiers fired rounds of live ammunition into several directions. Damage was reported, but no injuries. On Saturday, Israeli military gunboats fired shells and opened intensive fire at Palestinian fishing boats and fired a number of flares, causing panic among fishermen, forcing them to go back to shore. No casualties were reported. However, fishermen were deprived of their only source of income for that day. In other news, the Egyptian authorities allowed on Wednesday evening six Palestinians who were in Egyptian prisons to return to the Gaza Strip via the Rafah border terminal. Imad Said, spokesperson of the families of the Palestinian detainees in Egyptian prisons, confirmed that the six Palestinians were released and crossed into the Gaza Strip. Since the beginning of the revolution that ousted former Egyptian President Hosni Mubarak, Egyptian authorities released 46 detained Palestinians. There are currently at least 20 Palestinians imprisoned by the Egyptian authorities, including six whose place of detention or whereabouts are still unknown. Israeli authorities opened on Thursday Kerem Abu Salem crossing to allow the entry of aids and goods to the coastal region. Raed Fattouh, Gaza crossing official, said that Israeli authorities allowed the entry of 280 vans loaded with aids and goods for agriculture, commercial, and transportation sectors, including 20 new vehicles. He pointed out that two vans carrying flowers will be exported and limited quantities of cooking gas will be pumped via Kerem Abu Salem crossing. And that was just some of the news from this week in Palestine. For more updates, please visit our website at www.imemc.org. Thank you for joining us from Occupied Bethlehem. This report has been brought to you by Hassan Kassis and George Rishman.
Pakistan, yesterday, U.S. troops, two helicopter loads of U.S. Navy SEALs to be exact, cornered and killed Osama bin Laden just 40 miles outside Islamabad at a mansion. President Obama claims he was killed after a firefight, which sounds to me like cops saying someone was killed while resisting arrest. It is impossible to determine from this statement if Osama bin Laden fought to the death or was executed on the spot. Certainly a trial would have offered Obama a choice between a circus trial in New York or a military commission before an internationally condemned kangaroo court at Guantanamo Bay. Afghanistan, 27th of April. An Afghan military pilot opened fire on U.S. troops, killing eight U.S. soldiers. News reports said an Afghan pilot started shooting after a dispute in an area of Kabul Airport for Afghan military pilots. The shooter was killed in the incident. This incident had nothing to do with Osama bin Laden and everything to do with the effect of occupation on day-to-day life. Although the Taliban claimed responsibility for the attack, the Afghan Ministry of Defense dismissed that claim as a hoax, pointing out that the shooter, a veteran Afghan pilot and military officer, quote, opened fire on foreigners after an argument. Afghanistan, 1st of May, the Taliban announced the start of their spring offensive. So much for U.S. claims that they are on the ropes. Bin Laden or not, warfare in Afghanistan will continue so long as any nation's foreign troops continue to occupy the country. This has been so since the days of Alexander the Great. Continued occupation will follow up the U.S. victory over bin Laden with a U.S. defeat in Afghanistan. 7.5 years ago, U.S. troops captured Saddam Hussein in Iraq. U.S. occupation troops stayed, and 7.5 more years of war have been fought since that time. The bloodiest part of the fighting, the beheadings, the Abu Ghraib prison scandal, all of those were months or years in the future and could have been avoided. Mr. Barack Obama, don't repeat in Afghanistan and Pakistan the mistakes of George W. Bush in Iraq. Iraq, last Friday, Xinhua Net News is reporting the death of of a U.S. soldier during operations in an undisclosed location in southern Iraq on Friday, the 29th of April. Iraq, last Wednesday, Multinational Forces Iraq, meaning the U.S. military, is reporting the death of a U.S. service member from a, quote, non-hostile incident in an undisclosed location in southern Iraq on Wednesday, the 27th of April. Mosul, Iraq, 1st of May. A suicide attack on an Iraqi army patrol kills 7 people, 4 soldiers and 3 civilians, and wounds 15 people more. Taji, Iraq, 30th of April. A judge's house was bombed with multiple devices, killing him and wounding members of his family. A security source told Al Samira News that unknown armed men wearing military uniforms attacked many houses belonging to members of the Awakening Councils in a village situated in Taji region north of Baghdad. The attacks killed one of the armed men who was wearing a major's costume and wounded 2 of the Awakening Council members. The Awakening Councils are former resistance fighters who turned coats aside with the U.S. in 2007 and are regarded by many in the country as traitors for so doing. Iraq, ongoing. Protests throughout Iraq are demanding that U.S. troops honor the December 31st deadline to leave the country. Muqtada al-Sadr warns that his followers will take up arms against U.S. troops once again if the U.S. does not leave. In recent weeks, U.S. officials have been discussing continuing the occupation of Iraq beyond the year-end deadline. Mr. Barack Obama, you caught and killed bin Laden. The United States got what it came for in Afghanistan. Soldiers will be asking, can we go home now? The people of Afghanistan, Pakistan, and Iraq are all asking, can you go home now? Now is the time to declare victory and bring all the troops home from all 3 countries today.
The uprisings across the Middle East rage on, as well as the ongoing war in Afghanistan and the debate on the U.S. debt and budget crisis at home. But America's continued military occupation of Iraq has almost completely been absent from recent media coverage. Large protests have been occurring inside Iraq, where demonstrators have denounced government corruption and the lack of basic services such as electricity and water. Sometimes violent protests demanded the resignations of local government officials over the issues of high unemployment, repair of the electrical power grid, and a corrupt judicial system. In late February, an estimated 20 demonstrators were killed by Iraqi security forces during running street battles that also saw the burning of government offices. But the focus of protests changed on April 9th, the day which marks the 8th anniversary of the U.S. occupation of Baghdad, where tens of thousands of Iraqis demanded a complete U.S. withdrawal by December 31st, the date agreed upon by the Bush administration and the Iraqi government in 2008. A growing number of Iraqis are concerned about the recent visits to Baghdad by U.S. Defense Secretary Robert Gates and the Pentagon's chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, Admiral Mike Mullen, where they were negotiating to extend the time the remaining 47,000 U.S. troops now in Iraq could remain. Washington has indicated it doesn't have faith that the fragile Iraqi government can handle conflicts over oil deposits in Kirkuk and the threat of renewed al-Qaeda attacks. Powerful Shia cleric Muqtada al-Sadr has warned that his followers will take up arms if the U.S. fails to meet the end-of-the-year troop withdrawal deadline. Between the lines, Scott Harris spoke with Iraqi-born political analyst Raed Jarar, who explains why he believes the U.S. is playing with fire if it pursues an extension of the troop withdrawal deadline.
The protests started in Iraq as a part of the protests in the entire Arab world that started in Tunisia and followed that in Egypt and other countries. So the protests in Iraq started in February 25th. That was the first day where there was an organized protest in downtown Baghdad. And most of the protests so far have been organized online, mostly on Facebook, which is really fascinating because the internet penetration in Iraq is less than 2%. So it's really fascinating to see how a very limited number of Iraqi youth are utilizing this limited internet penetration to put together tens of thousands of people in the streets to protest against the Iraqi government's corruption and demand more services. Now, the protests were mostly about these two topics, the Iraqi government's corruption and lack of services, until the first week of this month, when Secretary Gates went to Iraq a couple of days before the 8th anniversary of the fall of Baghdad, which is April 9th. Secretary Gates' visit was seen as an attempt to delay or cancel the U.S. Withdrawal deadline scheduled for the end of this year. So from that time, the protests have been more politicized. Most of the protesters have been talking about the U.S. occupation and the need to end all of the U.S. military occupation before the end of this year in accordance to the security agreement that was signed between the two countries in 2008 and that President Obama promised repeatedly to abide by its final deadline to bring down the number of U.S. troops to zero and the number of U.S. bases to zero before December 31st, 2011.
Raed, tell us what led to the speculation that Defense Secretary Robert Gates' visit to Iraq was somehow a prelude to an extension of the U.S. troop withdrawal deadline, which, as you said, is the end of the year.
Well, it wasn't a speculation. This is what Secretary Gates said. He said that the U.S. is withdrawing on time, but that he urges the Iraqi authorities to move quickly and request that the U.S. forces stay longer in case they were interested in that. So that was seen as an indirect way to put pressure on Iraq so that Iraq would request the extension, because legally the U.S. is not allowed to leave a single U.S. soldier, whether they were combat or non-combat forces, after the December 31st deadline, unless there is an official request by the Iraqi government that gets ratified by the Iraqi parliament. Now, this does not seem to be happening, and people did not understand why would Secretary Gates come all the way to Baghdad, meet with top officials, and urge them to think about that. It was seen as an attempt by the U.S. to prolong the occupation. Of course, Secretary Gates' visit was followed by visits by other top U.S. commanders in the Pentagon. The last one was just a couple of days ago, when Mullen went to Iraq, and he repeated the same exact message, that the U.S. is withdrawing on time, but that if Iraqis would like to change their mind within the next few weeks, that the U.S. would leave 10,000 troops on the long run, which is something that is rejected by an overwhelming majority of Iraqis. The vast majority of Iraqis want this occupation to end completely without leaving a single U.S. soldier on Iraq's soil after the deadline that was agreed upon.
What is the rationale for leaving U.S. troops in Iraq beyond the December 31st, 2011 deadline? There are many observers who discuss the fragility of the Iraqi government and the possible reemergence of very great violence that might overtake Iraq once the U.S. troops leave. Is there any validity to these views?
I disagree with the notion that the U.S. is there to protect Iraqis from violence or to protect Iraqis from themselves. I think it is true that the Iraqi government is weak and fragile. It is true that the Iraqi armed forces are not strong enough. But these things are not despite the U.S. military occupation, but they are because of it. So while I agree that the situation is bad, I disagree on the notion that a U.S. withdrawal will make it worse. I think a U.S. withdrawal is an important first step towards fixing many of these issues in Iraq.
In your view, what will be the repercussions inside Iraq if the United States fails to honor its deadline for withdrawing all U.S. military troops? We've heard that religious leader Muqtada al-Sadr has talked about reviving his Mahdi army militia and has threatened armed resistance if the U.S. doesn't withdraw its troops from Iraq on time.
I think prolonging the U.S. occupation will be catastrophic because it will destroy what's left of faith in the Iraqi political system. I think abiding by the promises and getting out of Iraq is the right thing to do. It's the right thing politically, it's the right thing morally, and it is the right thing legally to abide by the binding security agreement.
That was Iraqi-born political analyst Raed Jarar. Visit our website to find links to Jarar's articles on the current situation in Iraq at btlonline.org.
And no amount of money you could give me, honey, couldn't pay me, ain't going back again.
On the 30th of April, Rupert Murdoch, the infamous Lord of Fox News, showed up at the White House Correspondents' Dinner and was pursued by a small band of rebels from Code Pink.
Suppose army recruiting ads had to have side effect warnings like drug advertisements on TV do.
The United States Army may not be right for every patient. Side effects can include distress, disillusionment, bitter resentment, isolation, traumatic and post-traumatic stress, sociopathic behavior, uncontrollable sobbing, uncontrollable violence, prosecutions for war crimes, prosecutions for domestic crimes, loss of contact with loved ones, loss of ability to love, brain injuries, blindness, depleted uranium poisoning, flashbacks, horror of death, horror of being away from death, loss of the use of limbs, loss of limbs, death, suicide, excruciating pain, the desire to feel excruciating pain, overwhelming rage and misery, loss of hearing, punishment by the army for failure to obey illegal orders, punishment by courts of law or by enemy forces for obeying illegal orders, torture, humiliation, shame, dangerous habits of blind subservience, or the wasting of what could have been the best years of your life. If you experience any of these symptoms, deal with it, sucker. You already signed your name on the dotted line.
This is WSQT Direct Action Radio, broadcasting on 88.1 FM from the heart of occupied Washington. We are news from the front line. We can be reached at WSQTRadio@hushmail.com. WSQT Radio at hushmail.com.
April 20th marked the one-year anniversary of the blowout of British Petroleum's Macondo deepwater oil well in the Gulf of Mexico, which killed 11 oil rig workers and spilled 190 million gallons of crude oil into Gulf waters and the adjoining coastline before being capped 3 months later. Since then, estimates of damage have varied, with the Obama administration claiming that most of the oil has now disappeared through recovery, evaporation, or eaten by microbes. But others assert the damage is more pervasive and ongoing. Since the British Petroleum spill, there's been a serious debate about the use of millions of gallons of chemical dispersants deployed in the ocean to break up the oil before it reached the shoreline, and its impact on the Gulf ecosystem, as well as on those who worked on recovery vessels and residents who live in the region. Between the Lines, Melinda Tuhu spoke with Daryl Malik Wiley, the Sierra Club's environmental justice organizer based in Louisiana. He talks about how he spent the grim one-year anniversary of the BP oil spill, the continuing disruption to the lives of the area's residents, and the formation of a new grassroots organization, Go Fish, Gulf Organized Fisheries in Solidarity and Hope, fighting to receive fair compensation from British Petroleum.
The Sierra Club and other groups did a number of events. We did a sunrise service in New Orleans down near Jackson Square on the 20th. We had a number of religious leaders and environmental leaders talking about the loss of life of the 11 men. So, unfortunately, that part of the story sometimes gets left out. So we actually had a moment of silence and then the reading of the names of the 11 men who died when the BP Deepwater Horizon exploded. And so that was sunrise, and I went from there to a meeting down in Plaquemines Parish on the east side of the Mississippi River to Port of Lahaj, which is a area where it's a small African-American fisherman community, mainly oyster fishermen. So they had a press conference, an event, educational event, over 80 people of a number of different fisher folk communities, Vietnamese-American, Native Americans from different tribes were at the event, and set up a new organization called Go Fish, Gulf Organized Fisheries in Solidarity and Hope. And what they're trying to do is organize and work with fishermen and fisher families for all the way from Alabama to Texas and try and talk about, you know, the unique history, culture of the fishermen and how seriously impacted the community was by the BP explosion. And how it's still being impacted with some people not being back to work yet or some of the fishermen who worked in the vessels of opportunity sick. So, and then ended the day with they called it a black carpet fundraising event to help set up some free health clinics across the Gulf Coast. So that was my day. It was sort of sun up to way past sunset.
And the vessels of opportunity, that was what BP set up to hire local fisher folks to clean up the spill, right?
Right. That was funded by BP to hire people to go out and do cleanup work and number of problems with it. One, the Louisiana Environmental Action Network actually purchased safety gear and gave it to a number of fishermen to wear and respirators and things like that because the environmental community knew about the dangers of the health impacts. And BP basically told fishermen and people who were working on vessels of opportunity, if they wore protective gear, they would no longer be working for BP.
Well, Daryl Malik Wiley, you know there's been a lot of different information coming out about the impact of the oil disaster. The federal government has said it's mostly disappeared, and I know they're doing a long-term study, but the people in Go Fish are on the front lines. What do they say about the impact?
Yeah, what they say is the oil's still here. You know, we see it daily, you know, tar balls are washing up all along the Gulf Coast. Just the way the winds blow in the wintertime, the wind blows offshore, so it's blowing, you know, out into the Gulf. Summertime, we start getting southern winds blowing stuff back onshore. So we're starting to see some tar balls come in, some of the oil come in, because all the dispersant did was just put it on the bottom of the Gulf. And so we're starting to see some of that oil and dispersant coming back up and impacting a number of different coastal areas.
And the dispersant, there's a huge controversy about that, and not just between the government and BP on one side who supported it, but there are some respected experts who say it was good to use it because it kept a lot more oil from washing ashore into the sensitive wetlands. And then others are saying no one had any idea what the impact would be because it hadn't been done on such a scale before. What do folks there on the ground think?
There is still a wide range of opinion. You know, the environmental community and fishermen basically agree that the use of dispersants without the needed scientific data, you know, long-term impact of this stuff, was not a smart thing. 1.8 million gallons of dispersant into the Gulf of Mexico. Nobody's ever put that amount of dispersant any place in the world. And so we don't know what the impact of that is going to be. Some of the people who are sick now, they've taken samples of their blood, and they're finding the chemicals that make up the dispersant in their blood, as well as Louisiana sweet crude. So, and having serious health impacts.
Like what?
Loss of memory, rashes, sinus. Some folks, you know, we've talked with, they forget where they're going. They forget who you are, you know. And these are men, all of them were fishermen, you know, so they were in relatively good physical shape. And we don't know about, you know, long-term health impact, but there's no immediate health care for folks who need it right now. And that's a big concern. People have been losing their, you know, health insurance because they're not able to work. So that means, you know, and they don't have money to pay for independent health care. So it's just, you know, a whole range of things are happening. A number of them have lost their homes because they weren't able to work and they didn't get paid by BP like they said they were going to be. And so just it's a whole serious impact on people's lives.
That was Darrell Malik Wiley of the Sierra Club in Louisiana. Learn more about the work of the Sierra Club in the Gulf of Mexico on our website at btlonline.org.
On the 18th of April, as thousands of climate activists marched through the streets of D.C., some of them returned a jar of BP's oil and tar balls to BP's D.C. headquarters. Huge numbers of marchers in the streets. The march set out from the Chamber of Commerce, raise comparisons to the World Bank protest in 2000.
Here it is, the main Powership crew rolling in on BP. BP right there.
Jar of genuine BP Macondo oil spill tar balls was left in front of the door of BP's government relations headquarters in D.C. on New York Avenue. Security guards complained that the jar of tar balls was a hazard and couldn't enter the building. But gee, BP, it seems to me you sure didn't consider those tar balls much of a hazard in the Gulf Coast when you were making decisions about how to go about drilling that Macondo well. So BP, don't be surprised when your gushers of oil bring a gusher of protesters to your doorstep.
While the vast environmental and economic damage from last year's British Petroleum oil spill are still being calculated, deepwater oil drilling has now resumed in the Gulf of Mexico. Soon after the Deepwater Horizon oil spill disaster, the Obama administration's Interior Department imposed a moratorium on deepwater drilling. But under pressure from the oil industry and their conservative political allies, the moratorium was lifted in October 2010. Government officials maintained that they would not issue new deepwater drilling permits until drill platform operators demonstrated their ability to contain future oil spills. But some critics believe that the Obama administration, hoping to appease the oil industry, rushed to grant new deepwater permits without first ensuring that rigorous new safety standards were in place. In fact, a Norwegian company contracted by the U.S. government to test the effectiveness of blowout preventers used to prevent a spill in case of a wellhead explosion found that many of the blowout preventers in use today around the world have major design flaws. Between the lines, Scott Harris spoke with Antonio Juhas, author of the new book titled Black Tide, The Devastating Impact of the Gulf Oil Spill, who talks about the economic and political power of the oil industry to weaken regulations on drilling safety and the widespread belief that the current spike in oil and gas prices is due to oil market manipulation and speculation.
This is, you know, hands down the wealthiest industry in the world. It's the wealthiest industry in the history of the world. Just this today and yesterday, the oil industry started releasing their profits for the first quarter of 2011, and you know, they had a bit of a bumpy ride in 2009 after having the highest profits ever in 2008 when oil went to $150 a barrel. But they're back, and it looks like their profits are getting ready to match those of their records in 2008, and Exxon's profits increased by 50% over first quarter of last year compared to this year. And that wealth is, of course, immense. And what they did in the wake of this oil disaster was to apply that wealth in a couple of places. And one was in lobbying, and they've spent enormous and record-breaking amounts on lobbying Congress and the White House. They spent a tremendous amount of money on advertising and campaigns. And on campaigns is a very important new piece of this because, of course, in the wake of the Citizens United Supreme Court ruling, there are no more limits on how much money corporations can spend on elections and electioneering. And one of the things I found in the tyranny of oil, for example, is that what's a regular occurrence was that oil companies would spend about 11 times more money lobbying than they would on campaigns. And that's not because they care about lobbying more. It's because there were financial restrictions on campaigns. Well, now those restrictions are gone. And so we're starting to see the industry doubling, tripling the amount of money already that it was previously spending on campaigns. And that is bearing fruit such that not a single piece of legislation written in response to this disaster has become law. But they tried to isolate BP, and in addition to isolate BP, to make this look like a fluke, just a random incident. But also, you know, the Obama administration is not an oil government the way the Bush administration was. It isn't at all, and it isn't beholden economically to this industry the way the Bush administration does. But the Obama administration has unfortunately proven itself to be far from immune to the financial weight and pressure that the industry has brought to bear. Every investigation that has looked into this disaster, including the president's own presidential commission on the Deepwater Horizon, has concluded that the problems that led to this disaster are systemic, they are embedded within the entire industry, and serious, serious changes need to take place. And what I conclude is, if the federal government is unable to make those serious regulatory changes, if it can't increase the skill and staff and financial capacity and regulatory oversight of its agencies, which so far it hasn't been able to, then that means we cannot do this type of drilling.
Antonio, we have seen a spike in oil prices and gas prices around this country. It's affecting the economy. It's affecting certainly everybody's pocketbooks, and it affects U.S. politics. There's a lot of pressure on the government to do more drilling because of the high price of oil and the propaganda from the oil companies telling us if we'd only let more oil wells be drilled, the price would come down, which I think has been proven quite literally to be false. But as we say goodnight, you want to discuss a bit about the price manipulation here that is alleged.
Today in the United States, we are producing more oil than we were at this time last year. Yet the price of oil and the price of gasoline are dramatically higher than they were last year. So supply has very little to do, unfortunately, with the price of oil and gasoline in the United States, although demand is higher at this point than it was at this time last year. So the fundamentals of demand and supply are not working. What is happening is that the industry is exporting more oil out of the United States than they were before, exporting more gasoline because we're consuming less, and from their perspective, we have a glut of oil in the United States. And in the world, in fact, supply has only been impacted a very small fraction due to the unrest in the Middle East. And that instead what's driving the price of oil and gasoline is speculation in the oil market and concentration and control in the gasoline and refining sector in the United States. More drilling isn't going to address any of those problems. Regulation is going to address those problems. And the last thing I would say is we need oil to be expensive. We need gasoline to be expensive, but we need to be capturing that extra cost and investing it into the alternatives we need to get off of oil altogether.
That was Antonia Juhas, author of the new book titled Black Tide, The Devastating Impact of the Gulf Oil Spill. Read more about Antonia's book and questions about deepwater drilling safety on our website at btlonline.org.
The 18th of April, climate activists under the banner of Reclaim Power stormed the lobby of the Department of the Interior in D.C.
Here it goes! Charge!
Sound from inside the Department of the Interior as the lobby is occupied by opponents of mountaintop removal, coal mining, and other destructive oil, gas, and coal leases that the Department of the Interior approves. Out of the hundreds of people who stormed into the lobby at the Department of the Interior opposing oil, coal, and gas leasing on public lands, 21 refused to leave even when threatened with felony charges by the police, and at the end of the protest they were arrested, though I don't know on what charges. On the 26th of April, animal rights protesters returned to the D.C. offices of Nomura, an investment firm holding stock in Fortress, the investor that bailed out puppy-killing Huntington Life Sciences with over $100 million in loans. Without Fortress, Huntington Life Sciences would be bankrupt today, and 500 animals a day would no longer be killed testing things like Fleach and Splenda. The protests are starting to bite, but instead of dumping Fortress, security guards at Nomura assaulted protesters trying to break somebody's ankle and smashed a bullhorn on the 26th of April. Here's an interview with a protester who was assaulted.
What happened with the security guard assault at Nomura to Huntington Life Sciences protest?
We arrived at Nomura just like we normally do. We made it inside the lobby when we felt that our message was adequately served and got the attention of everyone else. We exited the building, and as another employee was going in, we just went up to the doors a little bit with the bullhorns and everything, and we ended up, like, the security closed the door and locked it really fast, and we went around to the other entrances. During the course of the thing, the security guard actually charged out of the door, grabbed an activist bullhorn, threw it to the ground after trying to literally stomp and look like the intent was to break the ankle of myself.
And this was on the street, not inside the building?
We were just about 5 feet from the doorway.
Outside the building, though, right?
Outside the building.
Not inside his building, and he tries to break somebody's leg and destroy equipment.
Yes.
That is strong-arm robbery and assault.
Yeah, and unfortunately we didn't have a video camera to get all of that on footage, but it seems that the security is getting increasingly annoyed at the protest. We made it clear to them that we're never backing down until they completely divest from Fortress and Fortress actually pulls the loans from and provides proof of pulling the loans.
Maybe they ought to be annoyed at Fortress for bringing them all this trouble.
The what?
Maybe they ought to be annoyed at Fortress for bringing them all this trouble, or maybe their insurance company ought to be annoyed with them for exposing them to potential liability for medical expenses.
Exactly.
You know, you realize if you're having any trouble with that ankle at all, you could go to a doctor, have it looked at, and send the bill to Nomura.
I probably should. I mean, I was limping all day, and it's still, you know, when I move it in a certain direction, it's still, you know, hurts a little bit.
Have it looked at and send the bill to Nomura. They're the ones that inflicted the injury. Under the laws of civil liability, they're the ones that have to pay.
Yes, that's probably a good idea.
Call up the lawyer about that, and let's see what we can do.
Yes, it sounds good.
Now, Nomura, I've heard of lots of ways that investors can lose their shirt with Huntington Life Sciences and with Fortress. But that's a new one. Assaulting protesters and exposing yourself to possible lawsuits. Remember that attempt to close the West End Library in 2007? The one where the required public hearing was held on the 5th of July, the day after the fireworks? Well, those fat pigs at East Bank have once again pushed legislation through the city council to let them close the library and build condos on the site, hopefully to include a new library in the end. Here's a sample of our own radio coverage of what happened last time after a second public hearing.
This is Dial Tone for WSQT Radio. Library closing alert. The city council has passed legislation to sell the West End Library to East Bank, the same corporation that finances development in Georgetown. On Saturday, July 14, 2007, Joe Sternley, vice president of acquisition for East Bank, came to speak to the library. He was met with a crowd that had just been pumped up by an energetic rally outside, put together by Empower DC's People's Property Campaign, as well as some friends of the library.
Yes, sir. If indeed East Bank does not want to be secretive, then I take that to mean East Bank is for good government. As a member of this community, I insist upon a competitive bidding of ideas for this library site. And you must write a letter to the council and ask them to...
Now, with Fenty and the unwelcome spotlight he attracted gone, those fat slugs at East Bank think they can force the community to accept the closure of yet another library. Some community groups have given up and are settling for attempts to get concessions out of the deal. How about East Bank paying taxes to the city in excess of all that taxpayer money they will get to tear down a perfectly good library so they can sell condos for profit? How about we kick the rich off welfare and keep our libraries open?
DJ Munch, Chocolate City, this is movement music.
Have you heard the news?
Walmart's coming,
coming. Georgia Avenue, uptown, ain't that something?
Something.
Small businesses, shop owners, hearts pumping, company know their livelihoods is about to take a thumping.
Something.
See, you can't compete with a superstore who's an importer of slave laborers. Craftsmanship, low price to flip to undercut the market, hand over fist.
Walmart
is infamous for the way they behave. Low wage pay, treat the workers like slaves. Employees who try to unionize soon find themselves in unemployment lines. The way they treat women needs improving. 1.6 million sisters are suing them for being paid less than the male equivalent. On these issues and more, we can't afford to be ignorant.
Keep DC Walmart free. It won't benefit you or me. They ain't about spreading love in the community. They ain't about Chocolate City unity. Opportunists stop to make a buck quick. Suck up all your resources and then they split. They try to come across as if they legit, but really their motives are counterfeit.
This is the Funkin' Journalist with your three Walmart commandments. Step one, move in and crush competition by underselling. Step two, pay workers nothing and block unionization. Step three, take all that money, put it into the Walton Family Foundation, and turn that into political influence to protect yourself and make even more.
Walmart,
it's not a good fit for Chocolate City.
Let me holler black at you with the skinny. Important that you clearly understand and remember DC doesn't work with the right wing agenda. The Walton families are big contributors to bigoted representatives and senators. Trent Lott, sinister, Strom Thurmond, similar Confederate, state loving George Bush ministers. Oversee your plantation mentality, results in black and brown casualties. State neighborhood opposition for the district has been supported by Walmart's mischief. The D.C. Voting Rights Act was defeated, assisted via Walmart PACs, and now they wanna come here to see their money stack. Stay up on the facts, Chocolate City, don't relax and fight back.
Keep D.C. Walmart free. It won't benefit you or me. They ain't about spreading love in the community. They ain't about Chocolate City unity. Opportunist out to make a buck quick. Suck up all your resources and then they split. They try to come across as if they legit, but really their motives are counterfeit.
Keep DC Walmart free is an emerging activist group of DC residents stepping up to challenge the corporate big box invasion of Chocolate City. Walmart has plans to establish 4 stores in DC by 2012. Walmarts in DC will threaten small businesses, cause loss of more jobs than it will bring to the community, and lower the wage standards for all workers. To find out more and get involved, visit walmartfreedc.org.